The standard explanation today of all this misunderstanding that's been going on between the Nephites and the Lamanites and the Zoramites and the Gadiantans and all the rest of them, we would say, piously, is a lack of communication, wouldn't we? They certainly aren't communicating. And so here we have a masterpiece of communication. This third chapter of 3rd Nephi is the great letter. It's really a lesson in communication. It's typical of the official communique of our day. It's smooth, it's convincing, it's conciliatory, and totally false, as we will soon find. Lycaonius, now we see Lycaonius is not an unlikely name at all to find at this time and place. And Lycaonius, the governor of the land, gets an epistle from the leader of the other band. He has a good name of Gideonki. Yes, Gidgadoni was a Nephite captain, and Gideonki, which is a pure Egyptian name. In fact, if you're going to write it in Reformed Egyptian, you would have a very easy time of it to write Gideonki. All you'd have to do was write that. That's all you'd have to do. That's Gideonki. Jehovah is my life, Father. The Lord is my life is what it means. And here it is. His name's Gideonki. We'll get to him later. Well, Lycaonius, the governor of the land, received an epistle, and these are the words which are written. Now, let's see there. There is flattery. Remember, we've seen already in the Book of Mormon a great deal about flattering words. Flattering words get the thing done. If you want to organize a movement, you start out and you end up with flattering words, and they always work. Flattering words are those, of course, that people want to hear. Tell them what they want to hear. It's a very good thing in our society. It's become a fine art, as you know. It has become the cornerstone of the rhetoric of our times. And at this point, I might point out that it is not wars or plagues or famines or climatic changes that wiped out ancient empires and nations. It was rhetoric. This very thing we're talking about, that was the cause of it. Now, I've written some spiels on rhetoric, one of them. I'm not going to keep you up, hold you up with it, but we must make this clear what this rhetoric is and how devastatingly effective it is. It destroyed the ancient world. Before that, every period that is ended ends up with rhetoric taking over because it confounds all values. We started out on this article years. Now, this was written 33 years ago. This was written 33 years ago in Berkeley, and I was teaching classical rhetoric. This is what it does. The ancient civilizations were beset by a feverish preoccupation with rhetoric, which suggests nothing so much as a hopeless alcoholic's devotion to the bottle. It destroyed them. Everywhere, the ancients give us to understand that rhetoric, you can call it TV if you want, is their poison, that it's ruining their captivity to capacity to work and think, that it disgusts and wearies them, and that they cannot let it alone because it pays too well, and having destroyed everything else, is all that they have of remembered glory. That sounds like an extreme statement. Yet we go on here, and how the art of rhetoric was founded. It existed in other civilizations, but it became a big thing in the ancient world with the famous, with the old sophistic, with Gorgias and Protagoras. Well, Protagoras is a famous one. He starts it out. He starts the school. Gorgias did. These are both dialogues of Plato. They were friends of Socrates, and Socrates denounces them, what they're doing, as the most dangerous thing in the world, and it does have that effect, too. The charge is that he's turning the charge that Gorgias, his friend, our word gorgeous comes from that too, because of his gorgeous style. Gorgias is A-S because it's a Dorian name. He charges his friend Gorgias, he's founded the first rhetoric school. It's paying off enormously. He's turning out liars and businessmen by the scads, and these things begin to spread everywhere. These schools are spreading everywhere, and before you know it, there's nothing else. By mixing rhetoric with philosophy, he turned it to sophistry, for which offense Plato takes him grimly to task. The charge is that he's turning his talents for honest search for truth to the business of cultivating appearances. That is exactly what his teacher Empedocles, whom the younger Aristotle calls the inventor of rhetoric, has done. Fretting like Dr. Faustus, remember in the beginning of Faust, at the limitations of the mind, despairing at ever arriving at truth the hard way, there's just too much to be done in the short span of human life. So Empedocles decides he found satisfaction pretending before the public that he had already achieved knowledge and power. And he says, that's just as good as having it. have the same effect, you have the same satisfaction. Pretend you have. Learn the art of pretending. That will do it. He became the most magnificent of quacks, the father of a long line of skillful impostors. Well, you've all read the poem Empedocles on Etna and so forth. So we have the three big names here. We could start out with them with Gorgias, Protagoras, and Empedocles. And Gorgias wrote three famous books. One was to prove that nothing exists. The second was to prove that if it did exist, you couldn't know it. The third was that if you did know it, you couldn't prove it to anybody else. And so having settled that matter, he cultivated a new and wonderful art in finding success the easy way. He worked out a technique, says Philostratus, which enabled him to speak offhand on any and all subjects and to prove or disprove any point on demand. This is the skill of the rhetorician, you see, of the journalist and so forth, thereby bringing against himself the shocked and scandalized charge of making the worse appear the better reason. That shocked everybody, but you can do it. You can make any reason appear the best. Traveling everywhere, he proved to the world that nothing can stand up against the art of rhetoric. That's a quotation. His playing with words now captivated the fancy of the rising generation, and all that followed was actually a philosophical nihilism. Schmidt points out in his great work on the subject that it made a hash of all values, including the sacred nomos, the moral order of society itself. Now, Gorgias shares with his friend Protagoras the glory and guilt of selling rhetoric to the world. Protagoras concluded that he was wasting his time trying to sound the secrets of the universe in a short lifetime, burned his books in the marketplace, and turned to teaching rhetoric, achieving the immortal fame of being the first man ever to make 100 minas at the trade, million dollars doing it. His famous dictum that man is the measure of all things led only too easily to the rhetorical gospel that anything goes, the Philistine morality, which in the end destroyed Greek civilization. So let's put these two names down anyway, Gorgias and Protagoras. At least remember then, he came from Sicily, and he came to Athens, caused a sensation, and Protagoras, wonderful stories about them. They know exactly who they were. And they gave us the art of journalism, legal display, rhetoric, and so forth. Well, there's some things to note here. They go on and on. The persuasion, what the key word, the epicurema, the techniques you use. No, we don't want that there. If nothing is rarer than a good orator, nothing is commoner than bad ones, and the rewards of rhetoric were tremendous, are such rewards to be left lying about unclaimed until the perfect orator comes along? As might be expected, the worst people took to rhetoric like ducks to water. For rhetoric preached the gospel of success. The chance for everyone to succeed, he puts that, the success of career. Now this is Mommsen, the greatest of the German Roman historians, Mommsen. The chance for everyone to succeed was, Mommsen declares, the soul and essence of the principate. That's the emperor, the empire after the emperors took over. Its justification for being and its driving power. It was the schools of rhetoric under the benign patronage of the good emperors that offered this plum to every ambitious youth in the empire. You have a right to an education so you can succeed, they say. Quoting, people of every class became inflamed with a desire to achieve the new success. The orator's philosopher, says Cicero, is not Aristotle, who loathed rhetoric, but Carneades, because he was always successful. He never supported a cause that didn't win or opposed one that didn't fail. Lucian illustrates the spirit of rhetorical education when he tells about a boy who went to Harmodes, the greatest flute player of the time. And Harmodes started giving him lessons and telling him, you have to do this, you have to practice long hours. And this. He says, wait a minute. I don't want to be a good flute player, I just want to be a successful flute player. Well, says Harmony, no trouble at all then. You practice 1 hour a day and cultivate the right people. That's it. But success is what they were after, and which is a reminder that Isocrates, the founder of the first real school of rhetoric, ruled against the flute as a waste of time. From the time of Isocrates on, wrote Wilhelm Schmidt, naked self-interest ruled in the rhetorical schools. Success meant getting ahead. All else was eliminated. Cicero simply can't understand those Greeks who actually like to talk about things which are both hard and impractical in the schools. Those people have no word for inept, he says, with scorn, but play with ideas for their own sake. That, for him, is against the whole spirit and purpose of rhetoric and education, which aims to get results and no funny stuff. We should keep our boys away from such stuff, he cautions. Why study anything but rhetoric is the great Seneca's challenge, and he became the richest man in Rome. What good is astronomy except for fixing horoscopes and keeping appointments? It's like Vanderbilt, Cornelius Vanderbilt, who never learned to read because it would interfere with his business. Mathematics teaches me to make my fingers organs of avarice. That's as far as Seneca can see. Music is good, he says, because it is no good, because it will not stop fears, nor sell anything, nor still appetites, as rhetoric will. Geometry teaches me to measure a field. How much better to know the measure of a man, and so forth. It's human engineering that's going to pay off. And then Seneca's interest in things went only so far as they would support his case. But even the case concerned him wholly and simply on a pretext for pushing his own career. Cupit enim se e probare, non causam, was his slogan. It is yourself you're selling after all. Yourself. It doesn't tell your cause. You can take either side. It doesn't make any difference what product you're selling. It's yourself you're selling. And this was the philosophy of the time. For the rate of success meant three things, right out of the Book of Mormon: fame, wealth, and power. We're going to get that here. It does remember the four things that Nephi talks about, Nephi 22, 23, and so forth. Well, we talk about these things, but this is what ruined the ancient world, and it can, and I say this was 36 years ago, before we had the new developments of rhetoric, before we had the techniques here, such as what was not recognized as the fatal Gresham law by which bad rhetoric and art and education, like bad money, always forced the better product out of the market. There can be no truth between the two, and so forth. The discussion with Socrates Gorgias repeatedly confirms the definition of a rhetor as one who addresses the ochlos, the multitude, the many. Number is everything. The Nielsen ratings are the whole measure of success. Is the audience, no, he says here, the multitude is the audience to whom he normally appeals in the interest of his clients. Accordingly, the values of rhetoric are quantitative. How much? How many? These are the only questions you need to ask, he says. Gloria, like wealth, is a function of size alone. The greater the cheering multitudes, these are your Nielsen ratings, the greater the cheering multitude, the greater the glory and success of the one cheered. Now, incidentally, this article is the only one I've never been able to get republished. It was published in Berkeley and caused a great sensation, but internationally, but no one will touch it around here. Isn't that interesting? They publish all the garbage I don't want them to print at all, but they won't touch this kind of thing. Maybe it's too close to home. There is no exception to the rule. For all the fastidious and hypocritical protests of those scholarly rhetors who affected to despise the mob, rhetoric, according to Augustine, is the art which, animated by necessity rather than purity, scatters to the populace from its overflowing bosom, the Roman equivalent of pockets, an abundance of delights, thus leading them to comply with his interest. You can have whatever you want out of people if you only give them what they want, without question and without hesitation. The rhetor, says Philo, is the slave of a thousand masters. The public is a whore, her minion, her lapdog. What do you want me to do? Cries Diocrisostom to the people of his native city. I'll do it. And so it is. Give them anything they want, and that's what we want to find. And the orator must stoop to conquer, and a quick and frightening rebuke awakes him if he doesn't stoop low enough. For all his toadying, Dio was banished for being unsociable. Libanius, to clear himself of the same terrible charge. And Apuleius was investigated time and time again because he was suspected of being an introvert. Go easy on philosophy, Cicero advises. Don't talk over people's heads. They don't like orators who make them feel stupid. Best keep your books at home for your private leisure. You can see the direction everything is going in here. Everything must be, we're quoting again here, everything must be accommodated to the common judgment and popular intelligence. For the rhetor sells to everybody. To find out exactly what the people want, the hardest part of the rhetor's work, the secret of his success, was the canvas or survey. Well, this is your poll, you see. The careful trial and error game of empiria. Quote, to pick out just those things that appeal most to listeners, and not only delight them, but entertain them without ever tiring them. Now, this is what Brother Worthland does. He finds out what people want, and that's what the party gives them, you see, because that will get you elected. Whether it's our policy or not has nothing to do with it. If they want that, that will be our policy. Well, once you have that, he says, the rest is easy. Simply scratch and tickle the ears of those who want to be tickled, taking care never to speak harshly to them, and so it goes. The landslide of vulgarization once started could not be stopped. I say, it's just like TV. It all goes in one direction. Good men were intimidated and banished from their cities by mobs who could always count on finding orators who would never contradict them, society reserving its richest rewards for those who could justify, condone them, condone and confirm its vices. Even a strong-minded emperor tried to stem the tide, like Marcus Aurelius, could wreck his cause by refusing to play along with the showbread city crowds, and even risk his person if he dared to talk back to them. The orating bishop who tried to introduce a fancy word or new idea into his sermon might find an angry congregation shouting back at him, or even have a riot on his hands. There's only one thing to do, as St. Augustine observes, don't fight the stream. O vi tibi flumen moris humani, quid resistus tibi? Oh, woe thou tide of human custom, who can possibly resist you? You have to go along with the current and so forth. McGifford writes of the saint, he was instinctively conformist, could never be quite happy unless the majority agreed with him. What society as a whole believes, says St. Augustine, that in the Doctrina Christiana, what society as a whole believes, that we also believe, and without an inkling of a doubt, even though there's not the slightest evidence that it's true. But if everybody believes it, we believe it. So that's the way people went. Rhetoric didn't more than bow before the storm. It worked hard to create and intensify it, beginning with first political speakers who systematically debauched the people for their votes. Well, we go into that sort of thing then. Encouraged by the state to avoid serious thinking, the crowd became under the leadership of experts, not revolutionary, but radical, or radical but stoutly conservative, fond of rough house but mushily sentimental. In time, they learned even how to exchange spontaneous tears and laughter for the nicety and propriety of organized and directed applause. They had direct applause, too. They would lead cheerleaders. The Stasiarch would wave a flag, and he'd lead the cheer, and they'd all yell together and so forth. And so it goes, this unbridled passion for the spoken word. Well, what did it do? Something. Experts knew exactly what could sell and what would not sell. They had it all at their fingertips. Formulae that could get reaction as quick and predictable as a knee-jerk. Even those who knew it, how it was done couldn't escape the noose of suaviloquentia, as it was called. The general public didn't have a chance. The raters simply get them drunk, says Lucian, like selling Coke or Pepsi, and go to work on them. Flesh and blood can no more resist the impact of a good tried and tested rhetorical assault than it can take a cooler praising look at the Gorgon's head. You are paralyzed before you know what hit you. A properly trained rhetorician can make his audience clay in his hands, helpless automatons without a mind or will of their own. That was the effect they were after, and that's the effect they got. Well, we go into other things here. And the Book of Mormon is full of this. We get these flattering speakers who lead people this way and that way by the nose, and they're the cause. Every great movement, every great mischief in the Book of Mormon, it starts out with a person who is a master of many words, who is very clever and cunning knowledge of the language, and who is, above all, expert at flattering speech. With the introduction of the second sophistic, the arts and sciences of the West entered a period of decline from which they were never to recover. At the same time, the school entered on a career of undreamed of expansion and splendor. As steadily as civilization sank in the scale, the school mounted on high, till the one reached a peak of enduring glory and authority at the very moment in the 5th century when the other came to rest at its final and permanent bathos. The school never recovered. Everybody went to school then, but they never learned anything. This is the point. It's because of what the school became, the schools of education. There came a day, says Cower, when the cultural deposit of the past had become just too great for any mind to absorb, so they don't try anymore. While on the face of it, it had already been done, all future creation lost heart. They couldn't think of anything new, and they never created a thing for centuries on end. This happens, you know. From then on, learning the hard way was just too hard. The creative spirit was left with nothing to create. The only answer was rhetoric, the wonderful art by which an ordinary person could master all knowledge in his sleep, as the brochure said. Bring forth new and original creations simply by rearranging familiar rhetorical building blocks in the desired pattern. The very thing that stifled learning was pure oxygen to the schools of rhetoric. How easily they took over all the functions of scholarship may be seen by the case of the mortal Hermogenes, a boy wonder, it was the age of Precoce Puerili, had given an exhibition of his rhetorical skill before the emperor at the age of 15. His sweeping and pretentious rhetoric convinced the world that he was its greatest thinker, and his writing on all subjects became compulsory school books for generations to come, right down to the 16th century. He was being taught at the Strasbourg school and so forth. Hermogenes was the big one, and he never had a thing to say, but he became the great leader of education for centuries and didn't have a thing to say. It's marvelous, isn't it? And his active contributions to knowledge is exactly nil. He has nothing to say. As the brain that feels for the body is unable to feel in itself what is happening to it, so the antique school seemed utterly incapable of judging its own ineptness. The actual productions we have, they've been connected by Rabbi M. Rabbi of Oxford has collected 3 very fine volumes on this one, Latin secular poetry, the other on Latin, others on Latin religious poetry. All this rhetoric has been brought together not all of it, a great deal of it, because we have vastly more, but we have them all here at school. The actual productions of the world's most illustrious professors for centuries on end are incredibly imbecile. In reading them, we blush for the authors, yet they are perpetrating these childish horrors or joyfully exhibitionistic of their very worst themes, totally unaware of what a shocking spectacle they are. Rhetoric like Mephistopheles gave them success, but took away their brains in exchange. And then we get this, the horrible result of all this. You see, Book of Mormon. From the second century on, the chief characteristic of every branch of science and art is the inability to create new compositions. A stereotype that abolished the need. Things that bad poets instinctively love to fashion are the permanent legacy of rhetoric or literature. Look how the church has gone over for kitsch. All the art, music, and everything we have show a violent antipathy for anything which is kitsch, commonplace, low, vulgar, and easy to imitate. Our favorite author is a Seventh-day Adventist painter. Our artist is a Seventh-day Adventist painter, as you know, Harry Anderson. But he paints these Coca-Cola ads that are very, very folksy, very down-to-earth, no artistic value whatsoever. And so it goes, and so it goes. Well, here, in the rhetorical education sponsored by Augustine, Maru observes, an echo, an influence, there is an echo, an influence, a direction, a general direction of studies, this lowering of the general level of civilization, which already, on all sides of Augustine, announce that the times of the barbarians is at hand, and they're going into 1,000 years. A slump after that. So this is what rhetoric does to people and so forth, and what it did in the East and West. And this is, Book of Mormon is great on this, and this is a, you won't call this as a rhetorical masterpiece because it can't fool anybody. It's so transparent, and yet it does. This is the interesting thing about rhetoric. As it became more transparent and silly, as they kept repeating the same formulas over and over again, you say, well, people would surely get wise to that. Yes, they got wise to it, but they had an appetite for it. They were able to take it. It was the expected them. Finally, it was what they wanted, and it was all they ever got. And so here it comes here, from the band. He said, no, he starts out with his flattering. O most noble chief governor of the land, he speaks, I write to thee, epistle unto you, and give to you exceeding great praise. Now, he's coming on too strong, and so forth. This isn't the what Henry IV says of the Bishop of Bristol, who has been his bitter enemy all of his life. He says, for though mine enemy thou hast ever been, high sparks of honor in thee have I seen. So he wouldn't condemn him to anything when the Civil War was over. Because the Bishop of Bristol had been true to his lord, who was Richard II. Even Richard II was a fool and acted like a fool, and the bishop knew it. But still, he'd sworn and promised to support him, so he supported him, no matter what. He was loyal to him. That's why Henry says the trial, though Thine enemy thou hast ever been, high sparks of honor in thee have I seen. But this isn't what we're talking about here at all. This is just pure flattery. I give unto you great praise because of your firmness and also the firmness of your people in maintaining what you suppose, it's always what you suppose we are, what you suppose to be your right and liberty. You do stand well, and if you, as if you were supported by the hand of a God, in deference to your liberty, in defense of your liberty and your property and your country, and that which ye do call so. This is an ironical touch. No? Throughout this letter, he keeps contrasting his own Laconius' wimps with his own mighty men, you see. He rubs it in here. Much more effective, you see, the name-calling would be. It seems a pity unto me, see, this is ironic, he's being almost sarcastic here. It seems a pity unto me, most noble Laconius, that ye should be so foolish and vain as to suppose that you can stand against so many brave men at my command. Your people are all right, but you know, come on now. Who do now at this time stand in arms, the intimidating motif, you see, and do await with great anxiety, they're just waiting to come down, to go down upon the Nephites and destroy them. And he drops the disguise here. Mr. Nice Guy no more, he says. And I know of their unconquerable spirit, having proved them in the field of battle, their everlasting hatred toward you because of the many wrongs you have done unto them. Of course, there's no hint in there anywhere, the fact that the issue is the crimes and the outrages been performed all these many years by the Gadiens. They come in. He's going to tell us it's a noble society and we've been doing well, and you kept us, you forced us to do it. Everlasting hatred because of the many wrongs which ye have done unto them. Wherefore, if they should come down against you, they would visit you with utter destruction. Now, if that isn't a threat. But feeling for your welfare, he says, this is what worrying me, because of your firmness of what you believe to be right and your noble spirit in the field of battle, therefore I write unto you, desiring all you have to do is give us everything you've got, and then we'll We'll be your friends. Save us some trouble. Save us the trouble of having to beat you, Jane. We'll appreciate that. We would yield up unto my people your cities, your lands, your possessions, rather than they should visit you with a sword and destruction should come upon you. In other words, yield yourselves up to us, unite with us in our secret works, become our brethren, that ye may be like unto us, not our slaves, but our brethren and partners of all our substance. After talking about everlasting hatred here, he wants recruits, is what he wants. Remember, they're being outnumbered. They're having a hard time here. And this is what he's after. They've been using the Zoramites to recruit, as you've seen that. They've been doing it by using the romantic appeal to younger people. Come down and join the training camps down in the woods or in the canyons where they were doing it. And behold, I swear unto you, if you do this, you shall not be destroyed. But if you will not do this, now, as I say, no longer Mr. Night Guy. Humanity has nothing to do with it. You do it my way or... I swear unto you with an oath on the morrow month, 1 month, he's going to give them 1 month to prepare, you see. I will command that my army shall come down against you and shall not stay their hands, but shall slay you, and you shall become extinct, another age of extinction. I am Gideon, he, that's his name. He had no trouble writing if that's all he had to write. I am Gideon, he, I am the governor of the secret society of Gideon. Now he starts talking, most secret societies make this claim, that they're ancient tribes and that they're... And that they're essentially benevolent. That's what he says. We're a benevolent society. We've just suffered wrong, that's all. You've done all the wronging, and we've been your victims. And it's a good... the works thereof I know to be good. They are of ancient date. They've been handed down to us. I write epistle to you, Laconius, that you will deliver up your lands without the shedding of blood. See, this will be very nice. Hitler, nothing pleased Hitler more than have people just yield without it. He did not want war. But... Germans always enjoy war, but when he got what he wanted, he was Mr. Nice Guy. He was a very sweet person, Hitler was, when he got exactly what he wanted. And and here's the beautiful self-image. Hope that you will deliver up your lands to us without the shedding of blood, that my people may recover their rights and their government, which have been descended away from you because of your wickedness in retaining from them their rights and government. It's all our rights and our government they're talking about all the way through. We are the ones. You've taken it all away from us, so you forced us. We're the robbers. We're the real estate, and you're not. It's like the SS. Now, it came to pass, when Laconius received this, notice, he was nonplussed. It's total mendacity. He never heard of such nerve in his life, because he knew perfectly well. And it's obvious from the letter, too, you see. What did you, don't I? What Gideonki, what kind of man he really was and what he was really after. This is the... Yes. Well, anyway, here we have. Well, they'd wronged themselves. He said they brought it all on themselves, and he knew that, and everybody else knew that. This Laconius was a just man. He wasn't frightened. He caused his people to cry to the Lord, and then he uses the redoubt tactics against them. He gathered together the people into one place. What they're doing, he's launching a general strike, because he knows that these robbers depend on them for their livelihood. And if they just refuse to produce... and have enough to live on. But in order to do that, they must have enough reserve to live on. So they're going to have a general strike, have their reserves, and starve the others out. They're going to win that way. And gather them together, the women and children, flocks and herds and substance, unto one place. He caused that the fortifications should be built round about. This is on the large scale, you see. robbing them of their labors. And he's placed guards round about and so forth. And he said to the people, as the Lord liveth, except ye repent of all your iniquities, you are to blame. Are you the good guys? Large-scale crime requires large-scale cooperation. This is what happens. We've been told many times the mafia or the Medellin couldn't survive a month if they didn't have cooperation in city and town governments throughout the country. They have cooperation everywhere. I mean, they couldn't carry on their own. Any lawman will tell you that. They'd fold up almost instantly. But it has to take massive cooperation for large spread crime to thrive, as it thrives in this country today. So many people cooperating, so many people on the take. Who knows, you might innocently be on the take even without knowing it, as far as that goes, once these meshes spread out. But he says, except you repent of all your iniquities, you're not going to win out here. The Lord will in no wise be delivered out of the hands of those Gadianton robbers. And so great and marvelous were the words and prophecies of Laconius that they did cause fear. He made them afraid. The chiefest among the other captains was Jidjidoni. Well, now there's another There's another of these Egyptian names. This is a more elaborate one, Jedonai, versus Gideon, Jehudianki. Such likenesses are period names. They're common. You notice Gideonki and Jedonai sound alike. You find at particular periods in the Book of Mormon, the names sound alike, as they do in ancient times. You remember in the 5th century, everybody was called Constans or Constantius or Constantinus, or all variations on Constans. Then there was three rivals, Maximum, Maximianus, Maximum, Maxim, Maximianus, and Maxim, and Maximus, all different rivals. There were Valentinians and Valens, and there was Galerius and Gallienus, and emperors at the same time. You see, everybody would sort of share the same names, these twinning of names. But these two names are very much alike anyway. Well, the chief captains, they had the spirit of revelation, and they were devoid of military ambition. This Gideoni was a great prophet, and he was also the chief judge. Very different social organization from ours, you see. The people said to Jedonai, "Pray unto the Lord and let us go up and destroy them now," because they had faith in Jedonai. But he said, "Nope, nothing doing. That is not the way we do it," he says. "We're not going to make any preemptive strikes or any search and destroy or anything like that. If we do that, we'll get badly beaten." Clausewitz is right all the time. The defense is always the strongest position to take in war. So he says, if we should go up against them, the Lord would deliver us into their hands. We're not supposed to do that. All wars so far have been fought on Nephite soil, and they say if they invade, that's different. Wait until they come against us. Notice he says in the 21st verse, we will wait until they come against us. So we sent out a proclamation of Lyconius, and they marched forth by thousands. This was a gathering of stuff together. It was a big thing. Gather themselves together to defend themselves against their enemy. The redoubt. It's the redoubt psychology. It doesn't work for long. You must have enough supplies to outlast the enemy, and then you can do it. You must have strong enough defenses. They had everything they needed for that. It can't usually be worked because it can't last for long. You can be starved out. That's the thing. This time it was the other way around. It was the Ottomans, the Ganiantans, that could be starved out because they didn't have a source of income in the land. They wouldn't, if they started to cultivate or anything like that, they would immediately, the Nephites would descend on them. So it explains this here, what the economic arrangement was and the land bountiful. These are the people who were called Nephites, and there was a curse upon the land Norfolk. They did fortify themselves and dwelt in one land and in one body. The reverse of the Sietz, you see, the... And they did repent of all their sins. The people prepared in ancient medieval times, on the Vulcan, the great rivers of Europe. And the Sietz was an island, the big islands in the center where robber bands would retire. And they were their strong place, their very strong place, the Sietz. You find the story of Taras Bulba, the great Russian novel about the people of the Sietz. And this is the reverse. It's the good people that are in the Sietz now, and the robbers are on the outside. But they think, well, they have the whole land to plunder. Why don't they? Because it was burnt earth policy. They've taken everything off it. This is very effective, as you know. This is burnt earth. This is what beat Hitler in Russia. And Napoleon, too, because the people left nothing for them to live on. They did repent of their sins. That's the important thing. And did put up their prayers. And they were exceedingly sorrowful because of their enemy. Jedonai did cause that they should make weapons and so forth. And then chapter 4 is the general strike and how effective it was. The armies of robbers began to sally forth from their hills. Easy pickings. Found the land vacant. But that was just it. There was nothing there. The land had been left desolate. Well, there was black earth policy. And there were no wild beasts or no game. They were depending on those, save it were in the wilderness. And the robbers couldn't exist for want of food. The Nephites had left their lands desolate, their own lands. They didn't leave a thing for them, you see. Could have burned their houses and all the rest. Therefore, well, when the saints went south in 1857, Brigham Young ordered every house in Provo to be burned. You know, they had straw and combustibles in every house in Provo. Every house was to be burned all at once. They didn't have to do it, it turned out, but they were ready to leave everything and burn all their crops, leave everything blank, just like that. So they'd have nothing to live on, and that's what defeated Johnson's army, actually. They had nothing to live on except what the Mormons sold them, so that a year after Johnson's army occupied, Brigham Young stood up in a general conference and said, "I thank God for the United States Army. I am $1 million richer than I was a year ago." Because as soon as he heard the army was coming, he hitched up his horse and buggy. He had a black footman and driver, of whom he was very fond. And he says, what was his name? He says, "Get down to Provo just as fast as you can." So he dashed down to Provo and tell them, that the army is coming, that they're to double the prices of everything, charge a dollar a piece for eggs and everything else, and they did, and the army was glad to pay for them. The government was paying for it, after all, anyway. So they were able to sell produce to the army and get them, make themselves very prosperous. It was the greatest source of prophecy they had at that, a profit they had at that very difficult time that they were in. The army struck, hoping to wipe them out in their weakness, and had it all to them on a platter. Well, but there was no land for robbers to plunder, except that was their business, save to come to battle. Excuse me, this accounts for their generous offering. Armies do exist by coercing, by destroying. What kept the 30 Years' War going was a system that was invented by the Austrian general, the system of requisitions. The army would just go into a town or village and requisition whatever it needed. There was no talk of contract or anything. You just, in other words, it was plunder, living by plunder. And that's what kept it going. Well, that was Wallenstein, great Austrian general Wallenstein, introduced requisitions, and everybody started doing it then, but they couldn't make requisitions here because there was nobody home. And they took their provisions of every kind that they might subsist for 7 years. Now, that was a set policy in ancient times, the seven-year cycle, you know, the 7 lean years, 7 fat years, and so forth. We have 11-year cycles today because that's the normal sun cycle. But the seven-year cycle was standard. You would get enough food for 7 years. And this is a law in Israel, too. Remember, it's every 7 years, the year of release, the Lord's year. The year of release was the seventh year. The great year was the seven times seventh year, 49th. So they were just following the old Jewish custom of getting all the stuff you'd need together for 7 year cycle. And it was expedient that they should go up to battle again. Now they're forced to fight. They have no other source of income, the poor Ghanaians, so what are they going to do? They had no way they could subsist save it was to plunder and to rob and murder. That's the way it was, and they durst not spread about in the land. If they tried to do it that way, then they exposed themselves everywhere. So they couldn't raise grain, that'd take too much time and effort, didn't want to do it anyway. They would be sitting ducks if they tried to go out and farm that way, because that's what they'd been doing to the Nephites all these years. So, what would they do? What a picture. Great and terrible, they decided they'd have to make one big push. They're going all out. We'll go for it now. This will do. And boy, did they prepare for that in the seventh verse. Great and terrible was the day. Oh, it was going to be the steamroller now. This was Clausewitz. This was Schrecklichkeit, you know. This is the policy, the psychological policy of paralyzing your enemy with fear. And they fixed that up. They girded themselves in the manner of robbers, lambskin about their loins, and dyed in blood, and their heads were shorn, and their headplates upon them. Great and terrible was the appearance of the armies of Gideon here because of their army. Mind you, very much of the Teutonic Knights in Prussia, who terrified the people mostly by their fantastic costumes. And knights, they wear the head plates, you know, with deer's antlers and horns and wings and all that sort of stuff, and paint themselves as dragons, make themselves hideous, and go out by night, scare the daylights out of the peasants. This psychological effect was very important in the Middle Ages, to make yourself utterly hideous, you see. And then put a defiant device on your shield, defying all other persons. I think the best device would simply be put "you're another" on yours, you see. And then dyed in blood, their heads were shorn and their head plates. And it came to pass that the armies of the Nephites lifted up their cries to God, and of course the armies of Gideon, he thought that they had him, really had him now. They were terrified. It wasn't that at all. They thought there was a shout and a loud voice because their joy, for they supposed that the Nephites had fallen with fear. But it wasn't fear, it was God they feared, and so it went on. And there never was known a greater sky. This was not the literary style here. The battle commenced in this sixth month, and the great and terrible was the battle thereof. Yea, great and terrible was the slaughter thereof, insomuch there never was known so great a slaughter among all the people of Lehi since he left Jerusalem. That was the battle of battles. All one side, all out against all the other. And to their surprise, the Nephites beat them back, pursued them as far as the borders. And you can understand, this was the only time they gave the order to take no prisoners, and they didn't. They should not spare any who should fall into their hands. They did pursue them and did slay them to the borders of the wilderness. They got out into the wilderness. But they defended their own turf, you notice. They pursued them to the borders, but not over the borders. They defend their lands, and that's it. Gideante was pursued and fled, and he was killed, and that was the end of him, we're told. And the robbers didn't come again to battle. We got to move along here. But still they had to live. He didn't kill them all, you see. So a lot of them came. So they started coming back again. And the 20, they came up to lay siege again on the 21st year. And they cut them off from all their outward privileges. Every time they tried to do anything, you know, is what they tried to do, the people of Nephi. They should cut off the people of Nephi from their outward privileges. I mean, when they went to work in the fields or do whatever they had, to trade or anything else, they'd be waiting for them. And another leader, they had Zimnareha, and this was an advantage to the Nephites, just what they wanted because of their much provisions. They had enough to live on, but the others didn't. And they're exposing themselves is what they're doing, you see. The robbers had nothing to save it were meat. And wild game became scarce. That goes very fast, doesn't it? Suddenly deer became scarce in Utah this year. The deer hunt was very poor. A few years ago it was lavish, had all the deer we wanted. Deer, not this year. Who knows, it comes and goes. In the 1950s there was sort of a popular, when they were talking about the bomb and everybody was building shelters, bomb shelters and this sort of thing, many people had the idea that they could go out to the mountains and live there until the war would be open. Yeah, it would be over and it wouldn't bother them. They could live on game, this, that, and the other. They couldn't last a week that way. There wouldn't be enough at all. It's the same thing. They've exhausted their resources here. We don't have unlimited resources, inexhaustible resources anymore. Notice they went out by day and by night, falling upon their armies. It was really a retreated and beaten army, like 1812 or like Xenophon's 10,000. They just kept harassing them all the time. They had to do something. They're the ones that are desperate, you see. And Zimnareha gave command unto his people that they should withdraw themselves into the furthermost. So they really retreat now. Brigham Young says they retreated into the canyons and the gorges of the Red Rock country, Arizona, Utah, New Mexico, and so forth. That's the sort of country they went into. This became Gagnon country. Well, it certainly is today. They use those for various things. You better look out there. There's some stuff goes on there. Well, Jijadonai did send out his armies in the nighttime and did cut off the way of their retreat. And the robbers began their march. They were met by armies on both front and rear. In other words, they didn't have a chance. They'd been worn down completely now. So many thousands yield themselves up as prisoners. And their leader, Zimnareha, was taken and hanged upon a tree. Now, the same thing happened to Nehor, was hanged upon a tree. This is a very interesting rite that's mentioned in the Book of Mormon. It's not mentioned in the Bible, but it's an important one. We're told when the watchers were sent down to convert people in the time of Enoch, when the world had gone very bad and got very wicked, there was a sort of, after the sons and daughters of Noah apostatized, of Adam apostatized, there was a crash program to send down and try to turn things around, and these watchers were sent down. They were angels upon the earth, and but they were tempted by the daughters of men, and they fell, and they were led by Harut and Marut, and they perverted all the ordinances of the gospel. They had the ordinances of the gospel, but they used them. They preached they were using them in righteousness, but they were using them for evil purposes. And because they were the first ones who ever rebelled, as happened with the case of Nehor, because he was the first. We're told that Nehor was the first in the Book of Mormon to rebel against the order the Lord had established. They were hanged, and they were hanged, had to be hanged, because the earth would not receive them as it would not receive Cain, and heaven, of course, couldn't receive them. So Harut and Marut, to this day, and this is in the Quran, are suspended between heaven and earth, hanging there because the heaven wouldn't have them, the earth wouldn't have them, and until the day of judgment comes, they have no place. They just have to be suspended there. And then, of course, we can't even light the air, and then the tree here is cut down then, because it was hanged upon a tree. And this becomes an ordinance. You know, this whole thing is an ordinance here. They fell the tree and cried with a loud voice, saying, and then this is a chant, which they were all led by a Stasiarch, you see. They caused to be felled to the earth all. This was like trampling on the clothes. Remember, trampling on the garments. There's a very well-attested Hebrew custom that we have in the Book of Mormon, too, where we have the title of liberty and so forth. The people brought forth their garments and trampled on them and say, may God trample on us if we break our covenant. Same thing happened here. May he cause to be fell to earth all those who shall seek to slay them because of power and secret combinations, even as this man hath been fell to earth. It was the old Hebrew custom, you see, that Jonathan Z. Smith has written about. And may the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob, see, this is the old Jewish custom they're following now, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and the God of, they're reciting a formula, protect this people in righteousness so long as they shall call upon the name of their God for protection. It came to pass they did all break forth all in one. See, they're all singing, chanting in one voice. It's chanting. How about this chanting of a whole nation all at once like that? Well, we're seeing it today. in the main squares of Prague and Budapest and even Sofia and Leipzig, all over. And the people singing, the people all singing together in Prague, and they all sang the national anthem together and they chant these things. So it's a case of the whole nation coming together, celebrating a new liberty, a new freedom, and they all chant together. And here we have it in the Book of Mormon, finally catching up with us, see. We're finally catching up with the Book of Mormon, we might say. These things that sound so strange and distant to us actually happen, and they're happening here, you see. When it says that all the people did rejoice, saying with one voice, they did break forth in one voice, singing and praising their God for the great thing he had done in preserving them from the hands of their enemies. Their hearts were swollen with joy when God had delivered them because of their repentance. Well, we're seeing something akin to that in the world today, though whoever dreamed 2 years ago anyone would see such a thing actually happen. Well, now, we come to a happy part here. Now, everybody converted, you say, this is going to be wonderful now. Everything is going to go well from now on. And of course, if we know the Book of Mormon, we'll say, don't fool yourself, or if you know human nature. There was not a living soul among all the people of the Nephites who did doubt in the least the words of the holy prophets. Now, that's complete conversion. It's like the celebration of Salamis, isn't it? A magnificent affair. All the holy prophets who had spoken. And they knew that it must be expedient that Christ had come. They had already had the signs. Therefore, they did forsake all their sins. Now, this is going to be a happy state. Any bets? How long is this going to last, you see? Are you going to be willing to place any bets on this? Well, 6 years is the outside limit. Within 6 years, they were wicked, 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 wicked people. It's pretty good. Hang on for 6 years. Forsake all their sins. And they took all, what you see, they didn't kill all the prisoners, somebody, by any means, you see. And they had taken all the robber prisoners, and they caused the word of God to be preached. And they were rehabilitated, in other words. And they gave them lands, and they were set at liberty. The fourth, see, this is what they did to those terrible robbers. They preached the gospel to them, set them at liberty. And as many as were found breathing out threatenings against the brethren who hadn't laid down their arms, the unreconstructed rebels here, they were dealt with according, punished according to the law. We're not told us what it is here, but they weren't given the same satisfaction. But anyone who wanted to come around, I mean, this is fine. And they gave them lands to settle on. Then there's a count of the record here. The things that happened. Now, these are great times. This book can't contain a hundredth part of what was done among so many people in the space of 20 and 25 years. This is the 25-year period now. But there are records, a true account given by Nephi. I make a record on the plates which I made with my own hand, and this record is by Mormon. See, this is made after it's all over. He's named after the Waters of Mormon, where the church was first established by Alma. The Waters of Mormon. Being called Mormon after the land of Mormon, the land which Alma did establish the church among the people, yea, where he first baptized them by the waters of Mormon, where it was so beautiful, he sings the hymn about the waters of Mormon. Now, all I've given you is the Book of Mormon, and the 15th verse that tells us what the Book of Mormon is. See, it's a small book. A small record from that which has taken place from the time that Lehi left Jerusalem, even down to the present time. So we still call it the Book of Mormon because it was edited by Mormon. After all these things were over, see, Mormon is the last survivor except for his son, Moroni here. Yeah. I make a record of what I've seen with my own eyes. And according to our language, there are things which, according to our language, we can't write. Now, how is it possible that there could be something you couldn't write because of your language, that your language wouldn't lend itself to writing like this? I don't think English would lend itself to writing like that. I don't think it would at all. I am Moroni. Notice, there's a very interesting note on race here. I am Moroni and a pure descendant of Lehi. Well, I thought everybody were descendants of Lehi. Oh, no, not by any means. It's something to boast about, to be a pure descendant of Lehi. Everything is all mixed up now, by now, blood of dozens of stocks. So when he says he's a pure descendant of Lehi, there's a reason for saying that, and it's a kind of boast. He's proud of that. When he came out of Jerusalem, he says, no. Many have sneaked out of Jerusalem, including Rabbi Akiba, without anyone knowing, and says, we got out of Jerusalem, and you won't find any record of it back there, because nobody knew about it when we left. Now, and then he says, you shall bring again a remnant of the seed of Joseph, and surely as the Lord liveth, he will gather in from the four quarters of the earth all the remnant seed of Jacob, which includes far, far more people than you ever dream of. And we've seen how Abraham's descendants, how they multiplied and filled the earth at a time when the population had sunk almost to nothing. It had been a time of great extermination. The house of Jacob will be filled in his own due time until the restoration of the house of Jacob unto the knowledge of the covenant that he hath covenanted with them. And then shall they know their Redeemer, who is Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and then shall they be gathered in from the four corners of the earth to their own lands. Notice there's more than one land here for the gathering. To their own lands from whence they have been dispersed. And now we began a new epic here. We're on the lap that start racing now. The amazing developments now. We're now in 29 and 30. You see these others were back there. What was I say only 6 years earlier? Now what's going to happen? There's going to be one more very bad time, and then the great destruction, and then the coming of the Lord. These things go fast, so we'll have to take them fast. I want to get the coming of the Lord. That's very important here. We got to get at least that far here. We only have a few more times. Four, two, three. Yeah, three or four. I'll figure that out soon enough. So now these are the exciting chapters. They really pick up now. Now look at this. Book of Mormon. Here Joseph's been writing the Book of Mormon. He's gone 410 pages here. And he's kept up a pretty good pace. He's got every idea you could think of, all sorts of preaching, sins, everything. He's given us a pageant of a civilization, everything. But now comes the exhausting. What can he do to top this? This is a hard act to follow. What can he possibly say after that? Well, now comes the real climax. Now it really builds up to something colossal, absolutely. How could you handle that if you were writing the Book of Mormon at the age of 23 to play a practical joke on your family? So that's what Mrs. Brody says, you know.